go around and greet people on, greet people in the cloud Zendo. And then the people in the dirt Zendo will introduce themselves. Starting with Bob.
Bob.
Melissa.
Melissa.
Amelia.
Amelia.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
Ellen.
Ellen.
Paula.
Paula.
Pat.
Pat.
Trig.
Trig.
And I forget who else is there. greetings. Mary.
Mary.
Betty.
Betty.
Phil.
Phil.
Brian.
Brian.
Bruce.
Bruce.
Sabrina.
Sabrina.
Alice.
Alice.
Camille.
Camille.
And Ruthann.
Ruthann.
And in the Zendo.
Yes.
Dennis.
Lori.
Lori.
Dave.
Dave. Dave.
Jane.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Jane.
Jane.
Jane. Jim. And we have two folks in the dirt Zendo today who have previously only been in the cloud Zendo. So we're traveling between Zendos as Lori and Jane. So welcome. Okay. Oh, and Lisa. Hello. Okay. So, let's see. In terms of announcements, June 5th will be the Jukai ceremony on Sunday in the place of the Dharma Talk. So, attend that if you want to witness. I think we have about, is it 10 people who will be receiving the precepts and formally becoming Zen Buddhists. Four of those in the cloud Zendo and six in the dirt Zendo. Let's see. Yes. Also, I will be going on sabbatical for the month of July, as I did last year. This will be the second year that I've done that, in order to just do whatever it is I don't usually do, to rest and restore, and particularly to read. I don't have a lot of time to read unless I'm really just like preparing for a talk and I'll read just the, you know, basics. So anyway, what the Sangha is doing to prepare for that is to really schedule, you know, full volunteers for that whole month for the Dirt Zendo and the Cloud Zendo, and also for Sangha members to offer, to lead discussions, to present a topic or a Sangha member talk. In particular, I'm encouraging people, if you have been a member for a while, and particularly if you've also received Jukai, to consider offering a way-seeking mind talk. This can happen on a Sunday or a Tuesday, and we have a couple of them scheduled already, and that is basically the story of your spiritual journey. And every person here has had an interesting journey and faced challenges and learned lessons and has something to teach. So the Sangha loves hearing these way-seeking mind talks. So if you are willing and interested, I said, if you've been around maybe a year and received Jukai, consider this. We still have some openings, and you can correspond with me, info@brightwayzen, or with Jinryu, if you are willing. Oh, and also, like, aside from the talks and classes, just, I know everybody's going to be traveling and doing things during the summer as well, but if you're going to be around for any part of July, please, you know, be on the alert for requests for volunteers for staffing. And one more thing, we do have the dates for our next in-person residential session retreat on the calendar. It's March 2023. That was actually the soonest we could get dates at this, you know, point when we decided to schedule. So that is far enough ahead for you to put it on your calendar and to schedule around. So please consider, even if you are primarily a member of the Cloud Zendo, that you might be able to come in and participate in that in person. We'll also have online options for participation for that. All right. Any questions about any of that or other things I should announce?
Two questions. How long will this machine be in March?
The March one, we were a little bit constrained on the days of the week we could get at this facility, which is a cool facility. So it will go Monday night through Friday afternoon.
Residential?
Yeah.
And did you say the precept ceremony would be online?
It's also online, yeah.
Starting at
the Dharma talk time. Anything else? All right. So this is my second talk on our fourfold bodhisattva vow, which is our fourfold bodhisattva vow is beings are numberless, I vow to free them. And the understanding is all. I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them all. The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. So last week I talked about beings are numberless, I vow to free them. And that talk is recorded. That's what our videographer does. and then Bob also edits those and posts them to the website, at least usually a couple days after the talk. So if you are interested in listening to the talk on the first part of the vow, check last week's Dharma talk. So just briefly covering again the fourfold bodhisattva vow, this is a vow you can take as a Mahayana Buddhist. And in Mahayana Buddhism, we're all encouraged to be aspiring bodhisattvas. That the bodhisattva is aiming to complete liberation, but then he or she remains in the world to free all other beings as well. So this is a very, very, very high ideal, but we're all, instead of thinking like, well, we're just, you know, ordinary practitioners that shouldn't aspire too much, and, you know, there's only certain spiritual athletes that should try to do the whole thing. All of us in Mahayana Buddhism are encouraged to see ourselves as on the bodhisattva path. So we never say good enough. In a sense, good enough is essentially selfish and means we will fall far short of our potential. I mean, good enough means maybe we ourselves aren't suffering all that badly. We don't think we're that bad a person. So we're washing our hands of responsibility for everything else. But the enlightened being does not stop. So the bodhisattva, as I mentioned last week, never says, not my problem. But at the same time, Zen is not simply a self-improvement project. So this isn't about adopting an impossible ideal and constantly measuring ourselves as wanting or taking the whole world on our shoulders. There's an art to living the bodhisattva vow. It's not easy or straightforward. There is an art to it. It's part of our practice to figure out what this actually means to our lives. So that's why I'm spending a couple Dharma talks on it. So it's actually very deliberate and skillful that these fourfold bodhisattva vows are phrased in a way that are impossible to attain. Literally impossible. Dharma, the delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to exhaust them, even though they cannot be exhausted. Beings are numberless, they're infinite. I vow to free all of them. So by its very nature, it is impossible. So it defines a, it defines an aspiration and a direction. This is the direction we move toward freeing beings and ending delusions and entering Dharma gates, and it never ends. We don't expect it to end. And because the path is infinite, like I read last week, Shohaku Okamura says, no matter what our attainment, compared to infinity, it's zero. So in a way, it's a comforting thing that this is just so impossible that we don't have to really worry about where we are, how far we are. So this offers a direction and inspiration for our behavior, but that behavior needs to become sincere and lose its self-centeredness. So it's a delusion and a trap to think, I will free living beings. I will end all my delusions. I will become a pure person free from delusions. I will gloriously pass through Dharma gates, or I will attain the Buddha way, or not attain the Buddha way. So the biggest delusion that we need to end is about I. So note that this bodhisattva vow is something that, even though it's an aspiration, it's a direction, we're not being judged on, you know, how far along we go. We also, it's voluntary, and it's something that we ideally we choose. So, Roshi Tenet, my Dharma grandmother, made it so that the Bodhisattva vows were never chanted in just a public, all-invited service, which they often are at Zen centers, because it's a beautiful it's a beautiful set of vows. But the idea being, you didn't want somebody who just wandered in off the street and then they're taking this vow and they don't know anything about the vow, and it's a very, very serious vow. We do recite it after the weekly sittings, Wednesday through Saturday, but we don't have it as part of our regular Sunday chanting service. And interestingly, it is not included in our Jukai, which I think in many Zen centers it is, which is fine. But, people who are receiving Jukai will be reciting the Karma verse, taking the three refuges, and then vowing to follow the Bodhisattva precepts, but not the Bodhisattva vow. So that's almost like another level. So you can start reciting the Bodhisattva vow and choose to live according to it at any time. But, think about it. All right, let's see. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. So it's very important here that our second vow is about delusions, not flaws. So as we understand it in Buddhism, we act in harmful and selfish ways because of delusion. Beings naturally want to avoid suffering and be happy. This is fundamental to being a living being. Even amoebas, move away from something they perceive as threatening and move towards something they think is nourishing. This is like fundamental to just being a living being. We are going to stay away from things that we perceive as causing us pain or difficulty or suffering, and toward things we perceive as, you know, bringing us security or happiness or status or whatever. But the problem comes in the perception, is that we often do not see clearly. We're self-centered or thinking short-term or something, and I like to say we look for love in all the wrong places. So essentially, when you look around the world, no matter how terrible someone's actions, when you get down to it, they are just trying to avoid suffering and be happy. Now, their idea of what that is might be so twisted that we can't even fathom it. But at some level, it's the same motivation. So it's like this drive toward, you know, self-preservation is actually not a bad thing. It's just the delusions that we get that lead us to cause harm for self and other. So what are a few, I was trying to think, so what are a few of the countless delusions that trouble us? Is thinking we can, you know, one delusion. We can gain permanent security, comfort, and pleasure from material things. We can advance our own self-interest at the expense of others without repercussions, even if those repercussions are only internal. Another delusion, the short-term payoff of indulging harmful habits is worth the long-term costs. In the moment, it might seem that way, but in the long term, everyone cares what we do and think, or no one cares what we do and think. Getting what we want by unleashing anger is justified and effective. The respect and admiration of others will make our life worth living. The world would be a wonderful place if it weren't for those people. Paying attention to the random thoughts in my head during Zazen will ultimately be fulfilling. I am inherently flawed and unlovable. I can't be happy unless the past is undone, or the person who has hurt me changes or apologizes. So the list goes on and on, right? So there's a time and a place in our practice for simply trying to change our behavior in order to just stop doing the harmful stuff that just keeps on building the pattern, to change habit energy and to reduce harm. You know, so an example of this, of course, is classically just, you know, if you have an addiction, just stop. You know, just stop drinking. Don't even go near a bar. Just stop. And it can be a very, self-discipline oriented approach to just kind of get things under control. So there's a time and a place for that. And this is part of in our precepts. This is cease from harmful action. And we end up learning from that behavior change as well. It's not just mechanical, right? We get insights from, oh, I don't have to do that. This is okay. Or if I try something else, it's actually more skillful. But ultimately, lasting change comes along because of or along with insight. We see a delusion for what it is. For example, we go, oh, the respect and admiration of others doesn't make my life worth living. In fact, constantly seeking after that respect and admiration is exhausting and leads me away from who I really want to be. And if we see something like this clearly enough, our motivation to strive for the positive opinions of others will be permanently decreased. That kind of, you know, seeing through a delusion is like it depends on the how much of the delusion we've seen through, but it can be a very permanent and transformative thing. But this insight can't be merely intellectual, right? Somebody may have told you 100 times in this example, you shouldn't care what other people think. So, you know, you can just hear that. It doesn't necessarily make any difference whatsoever. It's only when we ourselves have a direct and personal insight, oh, I get it. You know, and then when we describe it to somebody, it's not going to sound very remarkable, but, oh, I realize. Oh, you know, like I've heard many people say, my parents were just doing the best that they could. Oh, you know, and then some forgiveness comes. Or so, thus the emphasis in Buddhism on delusion. Under all of our harmful and selfish actions are delusions. We think we're going to avoid suffering or gain some kind of happiness by acting this way, but we're wrong. In fact, acting based on our delusions tend to only deepen the delusions, reinforce the harmful habits, alienate us from others, obscures our true nature, causes us stress and dissatisfaction. So in Buddhism, the delusions and associated habits that we have accumulated, and not all of them are we necessarily to blame for, but because sometimes, you know, we pick things up from our parents and our culture and everything, but all of these delusions and habits we call our karma. And karma is technically a term meaning action, but over time in Indian spiritual traditions, it became to refer to because an action has a result. That's the whole idea. So, or karma, it could be action or result. I can't remember which one it actually is, but it came to refer to both. An action always has a result, and that's karma. So karma is the result of our past volitional actions, the choices we have made, which then condition the choices we make now. And our work in this lifetime is, in a sense, to clean up our negative karma as best we can, to establish new habits of practice, which lead to the end of delusion, which lead to wiser, more beneficial, and skillful actions. And in original Buddhism, it was understood that this process takes lifetimes. The Buddha was, according to Buddhist mythology, lived many, many lifetimes. He worked for many lifetimes as a bodhisattva, working on himself and learning and gaining insight and whatever, and it took him a long time to become the Buddha. And in original Buddhism, practitioners were identified as having reached certain stages. A stream enterer was, you were guaranteed to, you know, achieve complete liberation at some point. But you might have to, like, it might be a lot more lifetimes, but you will make it. Then there were like twice returners. You're gonna need two more lifetimes to figure this out, and then you'll attain complete liberation. Once returners, and then arhats, this is your last rebirth. You have cleaned up your karma because according to this cosmology, it's the negative karma which causes you to be reborn. Instead of like just kind of dissolving into the peace of nirvana. And I'm not suggesting you have to adopt this view. I'm just giving you some of this imagery for the view of practice. So it was noble simply to be working on yourself. And it was essentially selfish to get obsessed about how fast your progress was. So in this sense, I kind of like the metaphor of multiple births, right? It's just like, do your, you know, work as hard as you can, clean up as much as you can this lifetime. Don't get too worried about it. And don't get too like, oh, I want to do it this time. I mean, this lifetime, I got to do it. So the ideal that practitioners were working toward was the fully liberated being who no longer indulged in I, me, and my making, who understood that resistance to the reality of no self and impermanence was the greatest source of human misery, and that profound peace was possible through practicing the Dharma. And a fully liberated being was generous, not defensive, and no longer felt any motivation to kill or steal or misuse sexuality or lie or whatever. So like many other religions, Buddhism is pointing the way to self-transcendence. Almost all, you know, deep religions are point to this. At a certain point, you know, we have this concern and the religion says, yeah, it looks like that's how you should look out for yourself. But actually, if you manage to transcend that limited sense of self and that limited sense of self-interest, life is much better. There's much more of a reward to living with self-transcendence. So the way to this self-transcendence was through moral behavior, but also through meditation and Dharma study. So in original Buddhism, this was called mindfulness, which was methodically reflecting in meditation on our experience of body and mind, learning to discern and arise the passing of different states, and learning to disidentify with them, to recognize they're impermanent. This is not self, this is not me. And thus, you know, when things like anger arise, oh, anger is arising in me, and we're not as compelled to act it out. So this process of mindfulness is a very systematic, methodical way of essentially working to end delusions. And then we go from ending our own delusions to exploring the deepest Dharma teachings, particularly the Four Noble Truths, and finding confirming those in our own direct experience. So this original Buddhist kind of model of practice of cleaning up our karma, of ending our delusions, is reflected in a poem in a Chan scripture, the Six Patriarchs Platform Sutra. So this sutra are, say, six ancestors in China, Daikon Enno or Huineng. It depends on whether you're using the Sino Japanese or... He was an illiterate woodcutter, according to this story, and he ended up hearing a passage from the Diamond Sutra. Somebody was chanting it, and he experienced an awakening. And then he went off to a monastery because he was curious about learning more, and he was just sent off to work in like the rice pounding shed. He wasn't even ordained. He was just working at the monastery. And then it happened that the abbot of the monastery wanted to designate a Dharma heir. And he asked the monks in the monastery to write poems reflecting their awakening, their state of insight. And the senior monk at the monastery is Shen Tzu. And he actually, like, he knew he didn't really have that great an understanding, but he was the senior. He's like, everybody's expecting me to do this. No one else was going to submit a poem because they figured this guy was the Dharma heir. So he submits a poem. He writes it on a wall. And he says, our body is a Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree is the tree of enlightenment under which Shakyamuni Buddha awakened. The mind is like a propped up mirror. Always keep it polished. Don't let it gather dust. So our body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a propped up mirror. Always keep it polished. Don't let it gather dust. So the translator, Red Pine, says this, the mirror, they're talking about a round mirror that would have been made of bronze, and it would have tarnished quickly if you didn't keep it polished. So this is kind of a model of, like, you know, if we clean up our karma, then, you know, we can become this more enlightened, awakened, wise being. But it takes work, right? We got to keep up at it. So, and the mind, potentially free from delusion, reflects reality clearly. So rather than, you know, doing all, looking for love in all the wrong places, we see things more clearly and know what actions would actually be beneficial. So this process of polishing the mirror is much of our practice and remains part of our practice forever. We practice the precepts, we aspire to the bodhisattva vow, we remain alert to our delusions. When we find ourselves acting or thinking selfishly or experiencing fear or stress or anger, we know there's delusion somewhere. And we don't beat ourselves up for that. That's just the way things are. Delusions are inexhaustible. We just set about turning toward, identifying, working through the delusion so we can free ourselves and free other beings from ourselves. So this is where our karma verse comes from. All my past and harmful karma, born through beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So you say, all right. And once you get a fair amount of confidence and practice, recognizing that there's a delusion at play in your life, like, wow, that's pretty reactive behavior, or, you know, I'm experiencing fear or anxiety or depression or whatever. I mean, they can still be uncomfortable, but there's a certain, like, oh, okay, well, I wonder what delusion's under there. And then, you know, because of faith and practice, we're not very upset by that because we know it's just a matter of time. If we keep at it, that we're actually going to learn something and we're actually going to free ourselves from something now that a delusion has come to our attention. So, however, in Zen, we don't stop there because we may polish our mirror all of our life or for many lifetimes, but leave the fundamental delusion untouched. So back at that monastery where Shenzu wrote his poem about the Bodhi tree and the mirror, the abbot told all the monks, said, oh, that's a wonderful poem. You should all recite it. You should memorize it and recite it. So the monks are going around reciting this poem, and Hoinung hears the poem. And goes, You know, essentially realizing, okay, that's part of it, but it's only partway there. So Huineng asks someone to write a poem for him on the wall. And he actually writes two poems. So he says, Bodhi isn't some kind of tree. This mirror doesn't have a stand. Our Buddha nature is forever clear. Where do you get this dust? The mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror's stand. The mirror itself is so clear, dust has no place to land. So as we polish our mirror, as we work to clean up our karma, end all of our delusions, you know, by definition, we're aiming to transcend self, to give up I, me, and my making, to recognize that self-centered actions and agendas are harmful. Yet, inadvertently, we may reinforce our sense of self through our spiritual practice. As long as we may remain stuck in a sense of the small I, the I that polishes, the I that is defiled, the I that has a mirror that needs to be cleaned, the I that can evaluate in any way your progress on the spiritual path, the I that succeeds or feels free or remains stuck or inadequate, the I that longs for freedom, or who concludes our mirror is clean enough. As long as we're stuck in that, we remain stuck in the fundamental delusion that we have an inherent, enduring, independent self-nature. So if we do that, we've worked on our karma, but we recognize what we've been working on is essentially secondary delusions and miss the fundamental delusion. Like all those other delusions spring from that delusion. So we seek, even as we work on our karma and we work to end our delusions, we seek to awaken to the emptiness of self, because it changes our perspective on everything. Our vigilant polishing of the mirror appears to us as a dream. The polishing is fine. It's our practice. It's our choice. It's our way of life. It's our act of generosity to self and other. But it takes place within a much larger reality. That larger reality is undefiled and utterly independent of whether we ever get our mirror completely clean. No matter the state of our mirror, as we sit there polishing it, we are fundamentally okay. Awakening to the emptiness of self helps complete our liberation, removing the last bit of self-centeredness even from our spiritual practice. Now the mind, in his poem, the mind Huineng speaks of is not our everyday discriminating mind. He says, the mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror stand. So the mind he speaks of is not our everyday discriminating mind. It is awareness itself, which is the basis of awakening. And the body, embodiment, is what allows us to be aware, to awaken, to become bodhisattvas and buddhas. This awareness, mind with a capital M, life itself, can never be defiled. So realizing this for ourselves is the ultimate redemption and relieves us of a lot of self-concern. But, just to wrap this up, it is a mistake to think Huineng's poem supersedes Shen Tzu's poem. So this is very tempting, depending on your character, to say, polishing the mirror is a waste of time. It's a delusion. You know, the mirror doesn't even exist. Or that's a practice for beginners. Instead, we should concentrate on realizing the mirror is pure from the beginning and can't be defiled. This sounds easier than polishing a mirror for lifetimes. But this is a delusion as well. and one that's much more dangerous than thinking practice is all about polishing the mirror. You're not going to hurt anyone just polishing the mirror, right? We make some progress. We do grow and learn slowly. We make some progress on just that kind of polishing the mirror practice. And to neglect that work is to fall once again into the trap of self-centeredness. We're not going to bother with that work. So even as we keep polishing, we seek to recognize the emptiness of self. So we live both of these poems. We sit there polishing, trying to end all of our delusions, which is impossible. And we seek to awaken to this deeper reality in which, you know, none of it is defiled. There are no delusions, in other words. So I'll leave it there and invite comments and questions. And for any of you who are on Zoom and are unfamiliar, you can go like this, but you can also raise your hand by pressing the reactions button at the bottom of the screen, like Betty just did. And then like your little hand will remain raised there and I can get to you in order. And if anybody in the Zendo wants to ask a question, they can just come up here to this seat and then when we get to you, we'll unmute. So Betty.
Thank you. Thanks for this lesson. It's been very helpful. And I, as you're finishing up, I realize that I feel like what has led me to this to Bright Ways In and this work has been an understanding of my self nature, which is kind of wonderfully ironic that that's the thing that I have to learn to let go of. So thank you for the lesson.
Well, and what do you mean by that, you know, learning something about your self nature?
I think that part of my discomfort in life is kind of not really being comfortable with what I am and who I am and how I am in the world. So I feel like I need to learn that, but that's not really what I need to learn.
Well, it is though. I would say that, just to use the analogies that I've been using today, I mean, and in a way that's part of the polishing the mirror practice. I've spoken frequently about the Lotus Sutra, which is a early Mahayana sutra, which talks about our Buddha nature, but it has all these parables about essentially how people cannot accept the teaching, they cannot accept their Buddha nature, because of their own sense of themselves and their own sense of limitation. Essentially, what we would say in modern times, their low self-esteem. And telling these stories of needing to skillfully build people's confidence and faith, and then they're able to embrace the teaching. So, you know, I feel like from the beginning, there's been an acknowledgement that even though we're aiming to transcend the self and give up the self and see the self as empty, that we can't jump right there. We actually have to come to terms with and embrace and accept the self before, because we're not rejecting it or leaving it behind. We're transcending it. Right, we're opening to something bigger than the self, which most of us can only do, and once we heal that sense of ourselves, and so that's this process as well of exploring our delusions. Oftentimes, we do not actually end them; we just see through them. You know, we just. Like, yeah, that thing still arises. I still have that tendency. I still have that belief. I still have that attachment. But we have a very different relationship to it when we really see, oh, you know, if I keep going down this road, it's sad, or I cause harm, or, you know, whatever. So we learn to be more skillful with ourselves. So don't give up the self too soon. Brian.
Without getting into the more recondite dimensions of this, I would just say that I would be willing to bet, Betty, you have done an extraordinary job sculpting this self, you know, in nurturing your generosity and your courage. And so, again, I'll leave the more ethereal discussions for others, but I think that self is a wonderful gift in the world and is, you know, having the effect it's having in the world with the people that you know and that you love and the work that you do. So I would second the motion that we shouldn't get rid of it, just chuck it out right away. You might want to do some transcending, but no.
Right. I mean, because one of our precepts is do not be mean with dharma or wealth, share understanding, give freely of self. Give freely, because when it comes down to it, we got nothing else. This is the only thing we can practice with. It's the only thing we can be generous with, as imperfect as it is, right? So I think that's sweet. Like, I'm not going to, like, can't give you a piece of emptiness. That's not going to be very beneficial.
I'm confused by something. I know you were talking about Buddhist cosmology, that we don't have to necessarily believe it all in detail, but you talked about us working on our karma through many lifetimes. Mm. And my understanding of Buddhism is that once we die, there's no coming back. So can you make that make sense of that?
Well, because I had that talk recently. I don't know if you guys could hear, but like the, we're talking about working on karma through many lifetimes, and yet I thought we didn't, like, after we die, we don't come back. So I had a talk a ways back about the Buddhist view of death and what happens after death and all that. And it's really like, I quoted Dogen in particular as saying, there is no return to live after the person dies, right? That's right from Genjo Koa. And we say, like, there is, if there's no enduring inherent self nature, then what, you know, what would be reborn? But there are definitely, probably most Buddhists in the world believe in rebirth. And so the Buddhist teaching of no self, like, basically conflicted just like this with the cosmology, which already existed in India, of rebirth. So now Buddhism is saying we have no inherently existing self, but then it's still talked about rebirth. So it's like, well, what is reborn? So it's crazy making. I don't recommend worrying about it too much. But one of the most helpful analogies that I have heard for me was, if you have a flame on a candle and you have an unlit candle and you pass, you know, you light the candle from the first candle, you blow the first one out, something is past, but what is past? There's not a thing that you can hold on to that's past. So when I think about this, I think in terms of, you know, in terms of wanting to clean up as much karma as we can this lifetime, regardless of whether we believe in rebirth or not, even if you don't literally believe in rebirth, if you die and you have been a real pain in the ass to everybody in your life, and you have, you know, lied and cheated and abused and stolen, and like you are leaving a mess. And whether or not there's some you that, you know, goes through the ether and gets reborn into another life, something is left. And I like to think, well, if we're talking about we are not separate from anything, that our self is boundless, then we are not separate from that which continues as well. That mess we've continued, the misery we have left for other people to clean up, we are not separate from. We don't get to just like, all right, I'm gone. As opposed to if you think of doing our very best to clean up our karma, so that for the most part, what we have is a positive effect on people. We're not, you know, using people to meet our own needs. You know, what I think all of us have known people like this. When they die, it's a clean death. It's like nothing carries over. Maybe some positive stuff carries over, but a lot of it is just, now that person is gone and I'm glad they were here, but they have not left any residue. Mm-hmm. So that's where I find that whole rebirth thing a helpful metaphor. Like to think prolonged silences are good for the introverts. Go ahead, Bruce.
Hi. I have a question about the whole karma thing. When we recite the Gatha of Atonement every Sunday, right? So does that wipe everything, all the bad karma out, just automatically, just because we feel bad about it? That seems like a childish question, but that seems to me like it's the Buddhist version of Catholic confession, maybe. I had, you know, my previous life, I was a Catholic, sort of.
Yeah. Well, that's probably why you're interpreting it that way, because in the Buddhist setting, it's very different. So like when we have our 16 bodhisattva precepts, and it starts with the karma verse, and then there's the three refuges, three pure precepts, and 10 grave precepts. And the idea is that like it starts with that admission of our shitty karma. And then all this stuff that comes after, that's all the work that you do. So it's like that's just the beginning. That's like, you can't get to work on it unless you admit you have a problem. That is the admission. Right. You have a problem.
Right.
Not a shameful, like, I'm going to beat myself up for it now, but right. saying, so another translation of that could be all my past and harmful karma. So first of all, and we're saying from the beginningless past, like, it's not just mine. You are the way you are because your parents were screwed up and their parents were screwed up and their parents, like, our culture is screwed up. Who, you can't trace it all the way back, right? Here we go. So from beginning with greed, hate, and delusion, I've ended up with this karma and I am taking responsibility for it. So that's the I now.
Okay. Yeah.
I now fully avow is kind of the translation I prefer, like, or I atone for it all means, I'm taking responsibility for it. So I'm not going to blame anybody else for it. I'm not going to just try to figure out where it came from, unless maybe that's helpful. But for the most part, I'm gonna do what I can to clean this up.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you everybody for being here. Cool. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Have a good day.